you're in an Uber, you're at the restaurant or wherever it is, and someone makes some flippant comment about, oh, almonds use this much water, or farmers are poisoning the bees, or whatever it may be, right? And you go, oh, I think so often we take it, we just keep our mouths shut and don't say anything because we feel like we're the bad guy and we've been made the bad guy. I think that that reaction I've definitely seen. I'm to the point where I don't do that anymore. I just kind of go, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. Did you know I am a farmer? And I don't do that. And instantly, the light goes on and they go, oh, you are. I mean, it's like they just caught a unicorn. We should play up the fact that there's only 1.5% of us.
Welcome to Talk Farm to Me. You are in for a ride today. Aubrey Betancourt is a fourth generation farmer, a water expert, and the president and CEO of the California Almond Alliance. She is a bit of a unicorn, actually. But that doesn't even give you a hint of what we cover today. Do you eat almonds? Drink almond milk? My mom makes an amazing lemon cake with almond flour. Oh boy, is it good. Her famous lemon cake. Maybe you've heard that almonds that are grown predominantly in California take a lot of water to produce. Have you also heard that our nation's beekeepers truck their bees to California by the millions to pollinate almond groves? They do. But that is a simplistic look at this corner of the farming world. We are going to get into it all here, and I suggest you fasten your seatbelt because Aubrey operates at warp speed, and keeping up is going to feel like driving on the Autobahn. Talk Farm to Me. It's really the only place you can meet and talk with a farmer face to face about the amazing work that they do. Unless you are ready to hang off the side of a combine while they whip around the farm from dawn to dusk, this is more comfortable. Trust me. And you being here is pretty important, too. That you want to hear from farmers is critical. Why? Farmers are the lifeblood of our country, our entire planet. Go ahead, make a list of all the things that you could do without. Farmers would not be on that list. When you're done listening here today, share this episode with a friend. Let's get more people here to talk farm with us. Farmers do so much. It's the least we can do to help them get the recognition and attention they deserve. Otherwise, the products lead. You think about the almonds, not the growers and what they face. Today, Aubrey Betancourt will help you understand the head-spinning laundry list of what almond farmers are up against. Are you ready? Let's just get our bearings here. As president and CEO of the California Almond Alliance, Aubrey represents a collective of almond farmers. And how many almond farmers are a part of your alliance?
So it's 7,600 almond farmers in the United States, just over 100 haulers, shellers, and processors. Roughly 90% of them are family owned, and about 70% of them are under 100 acres. So it's this amazing small community with this incredible global footprint when you think about it, that California produces 90% of the nation's almonds and 80% of the world's almonds. It's unbelievable. 7,600 farmers provide 80% of the world's almonds.
Aubrey didn't grow up in almonds, but her experience in farming, in government, and with water give Aubrey a very unique perspective and set of qualifications. Let's start at the beginning.
I know you're a fourth generation farmer, and I'd like to understand a little bit about maybe what your childhood was like growing up on the farm and what kind of farm you grew up on.
So fourth generation in Kings County, California. My great-grandfather immigrated from Portugal when he was 18. He had a cousin actually less than a mile from where my family's farm is that he was working with and went to work there in the dairy industry. And he worked his way up and bought a dairy and turned that into a very successful business for he and his wife and his kids, my grandfather and great uncle. My dad grew up on that same dairy farm. That was 1941 when my great grandfather bought it. But my dad didn't like cows. So he took off and ended up doing a lot of work in processing tomatoes and really ended up, he won't brag about it, but I will. He was one of the first to pilot growing Pima cotton in California. Up until that time, we'd had a single variety law in California. It was this idea of trying to create a premium for California cotton. And at the time, California grew a lot of cotton. You know, the Boswell family and company had really defined that. And it was this idea that all California grew all one variety. So if you bought and traded California cotton, it was this idea of creating consistency and a premium. My dad and one of the gentlemen he was managing for, and that's predominantly what my dad did was farm management. He got this pilot going and started growing Pima cotton and was very successful at doing so. And so actually opened up the California market to being able to grow other varieties. By the time I came along and was growing up, we were managing for other folks growing Pima. We leased some ground, rented some ground and doing row crops predominantly. I remember doing onions when we were kids, garlic, garbanzo beans, mostly row crops. And then we bought the family farm back, the original farm back in 1992. And at that point, it was no longer a dairy. It's about 100 acres. And we did a little bit of row cropping, but we started putting in permanent crops. We put in walnuts at the time. And then later on, we put in almonds. I grew up baling hay in high school. So I would go out, you know, I'd be in school all day and then sports and homework in the afternoon. I might catch a little nap. And then I would go out with my dad and my uncle and we would bale hay about 50 miles from our house, west of us on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. And so I'd bail from about 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. and then come back to the house, go back to sleep, get up, get on a bus about 6:37 in the morning, go to school and start all over again. And so that was kind of my farm experience. And then my parents did everything they could to get us out of farming. They felt like it was a really tough life. They saw the challenges coming in California from a water perspective, from a regulatory perspective. And they just really were determined that my brother and I in particular, I have two older kind of gals that were my parents raised, pseudo adopted, you know, unofficially adopted sisters. And they really worked to get us into other industry. And so I went off and studied history, actually. I did work, but they wanted us to work in farming to know two lessons. They wanted us to understand, obviously, that work ethic, the idea of being self-driven. The other thing they wanted us to understand, and it's something that I've applied in my business career, I've applied it in my personal life. It's one of the most beautiful lessons my family ever taught me, which is in farming, business is family and family is business. You have to hold up your end of the deal as a good daughter, as a good wife, as a good husband, have a good relationship personally. If the business is going to be successful and you have to hold up your end of the deal and your responsibility to the business, if the family is going to be successful. And so this idea that not only is the interpersonal relationship important and the communication that you have and the development, holding yourself to those standards, it's, you know, is important to the family's health, but it's also important to the business's health. And that was probably the greatest lesson I learned. So I worked actually, I walked fields I was a field scout for Helena Chemical for a while. I thought, I'm out of here. I'm going to go work in national security. My passion was really in service, and I thought I wanted to be Jack Ryan in a skirt.
Jack Ryan is a fictional character created by best-selling spy novelist Tom Clancy and featured in a series on Amazon Prime Video starting in 2018, now in its third season. Ryan is a CIA analyst ripped from his desk job into a wild world of counterterrorism.
So I took off and studied history and took internships in Washington, D.C. and thought that was going to be my life. And then I got really exhausted studying Southeast Asian geopolitical activity and decided to write my thesis on beginning of the water rights structure of California. I was fascinated by some recent decisions in the Endangered Species Act that were having an effect on the water supplies of the state. And so I just did a personal study of it. And then I thought I was done. Okay, it's out of my system. I'll move on. Divine Right Order had it differently. I graduated college, ended up having to have a reconstructive surgery. So I was back on the farm waiting for surgery. for an injury. And I was working in the office for my dad and, you know, driving tractor, whatever else he needed, picking up parts, you know, whatever I could do physically at the time. And I was going to meetings and I was fascinated reading press releases. And so I just started calling the names on the top of press releases for water districts and saying, hey, I saw your press release. I'd love to buy a cup of coffee for you. Can we have a chat? And I want to learn more. And that's how I built this network of amazing mentors and colleagues. And that one thing led to another. I ended up involved in water policy as pertained to agricultural water use. And so I built that out as the executive director of the California Water Alliance for 10 years, ended up on a number of advisory panels nationwide in the ag space as well. And in the water space, I studied water management in Australia with an agricultural emphasis for a while. And all of that, you know, came back around to partway through my career. My dad actually had an accident. So I stopped my water work and went and farmed full time and managed our custom farming as well. And it was one of the best conversations we ever had. My dad kind of looked at me and went, so I guess you're the farmer. And I said, yeah, I guess I'm the farmer. And he kind of paused and he goes, I said, are you okay with that? And he goes, yeah. And he's like, no law school? I said, no, Dad, I know how to hire really good attorneys now. And he goes, okay, all right. So, you know, it's been a wonderful journey. I have loved that I found at such an early age in my life and career that if I was in service to my community, I was in service to my country. And so it has led me on a beautiful journey of service.
Service? Do you look at farmers as being in public service, like a firefighter or a mail carrier, making sure that you have food? It is an interesting way to think about farmers for sure.
I ended up becoming the state executive director for the Farm Service Agency for California, which was like being a little mini ambassador for California ag. So I'm an unapologetic California farm girl. I know we're divas and I think we should be. I kind of demand it. I have total respect for my ag brethren and I've learned about ag all over the country and all over the world. And I think we all just have a beautiful story to tell and bring so much to the world. When you really think about that 1.5% of the American public feeds the rest, that is an exceptional story and an exceptional community. And we should be so proud of who we are and what we do. And then from there, I went on to, because I had kind of my feet in two worlds. My feet is in agriculture and my feet are, you know, I also am in natural resource management. So I ended up going on to become the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Water and Science at the Department of the Interior. So I work predominantly with the Bureau of Reclamation, which is Western Water, and with the U.S. Geological Survey on the science side, the earth sciences and data collection side. And one of my biggest tasks, besides just internal at Interior and a lot of the great work we did around infrastructure investment and title transfer and requiring good science in the management of our water supplies and really, I think, making some great strides in modernizing our policies around water and water infrastructure. But one of the challenges and tasks that I was put in charge of was to actually bring into alignment the six agencies of federal government that have jurisdiction in the water space. So I joke that I was at Interior, but I'm conversational in the language of Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, USDA, Army Corps of Engineers, EA, and Interior. So I had to learn the water space in all six of those agencies and work on bringing them into a better alignment for a more efficient and direct water policy for the nation, which we didn't have. Interestingly enough, the United States does not have a Department of Water. The rest of the world does. We have six departments that have their fingers in it for different parts of it.
So let me stop you there for one second, just because I used to work for the feds long ago and with a lot of different agencies. And I certainly understand if you can speak those languages. I mean, you have a PhD in acronyms for sure.
Yeah, sure.
But tell me when you're looking at water or all of those agencies are looking at water, what the differences are.
Sure. I have a theory. This is just an Aubrey theory. This is just based on my experience. As I approached it, you have to look at how they're structured. So obviously the legal structure that created them and how they fit within their own departments. And then you have to look at how they're budgeted. I find that a lot of federal agencies gain their personality based on how the funds are distributed to and through them. And you then understand what motivates them and how they prioritize based on that. And so when you kind of had that understanding of, okay, Army Corps' job, the best example we always used was Army Corps versus the Bureau of Reclamation. Army Corps' job is flood protection. Their job is to move water, get it out of the way as quickly and as fast as possible. Bureau of Reclamation's job is to hang on to as much water as they possibly can and deliver it on demand. They have completely conflicting missions. And the irony is they share infrastructure in certain places. Folsom Dam in California is both an Army Corps facility and a reclamation facility. It is in constant conflict with itself over when to hold water and when to release water. So one of the things we worked on there was we actually rewrote the dam operating manual for the dam that said instead of releasing water based on a calendar or, you know, set times on the calendar, how about we look at real-time hydrology and you look at the long-term forecast as well as the short-term forecast to know how much your capacity levels are and how much you can afford to hold and how much you need to release at what rate in order to protect from flooding. And that actually has both in Folsom, but also we've used other technologies in other locations. We've actually increased the volume of water at certain facilities, not by building a new dam, but by changing the operational structure so we actually maximize the water that we while still protecting from flood. So that's one of those examples. It's also, you know, understanding in the budgeting side of that too, Army Corps has what's called the Chief's Report. They're given a pile of money and the chief of the Army Corps gets to say, this is how I'm going to spend it and give that back to Congress. Bureau of Reclamation, unfortunately, has separate authorities and separate appropriations. So the Bureau of Reclamation can only appropriate dollars and use and work on projects on an individual authority level. So it has, it basically is an earmarked design budget. So when earmarks went away, the Bureau of Reclamation really got behind on operations and maintenance because it could only work on things it was directed specifically by Congress and given specific dollars to work on. And when earmarks went out, the Bureau lost a lot of its ability to be responsive to its own stuff. So that's something that we got creative with and looked at how we could, what within the law and working with Congress and working with the administration, really put investments in operations and maintenance and dam safety, which allowed us to also do examinations for capacity increases to meet our modern demands of our infrastructure. So those are some of the examples. I know that was really wonky, but that was probably the best example I could give you.
So let me ask you this. You sit in one of the states with one of the biggest issues with water. We see there are wildfires and there are droughts. Droughts are coming about more frequently and for longer periods of time, and wildfires are coming and having devastating effects. But there are sort of two ways to look at that, right? There's a drought and then there's water management, right? I don't know how all of these factors affect California and California's water, whether it's drip irrigation or handling agriculture differently, or maybe even outside of agriculture. I mean, the water gets certain priorities in different places that are for different uses. So I'm just curious if you can help us understand all of that.
I've got three rules of California water, and we do hear the headlines of it. You know, you nailed it. To be honest, California, in my opinion, California became the fifth largest global economy in less than 100 years because it figured out how to deliver water 365 days a year. We are incredibly blessed with a Mediterranean climate that spans 800 miles long and 50 miles wide on amazing loamy soil.
I am just going to interject here for a second to define loam. It's a key ingredient in California's growing prowess. Loamy soil is a mix of clay, sand, and silt in equal parts. It's more fertile compared to other types of soil because the clay helps hold on to water and doesn't lose essential plant nutrients when water passes through it.
And so literally just add water and anything will grow here and we can grow year round. And so the first rule of California water is to understand that 2/3 of the rain and snow is in the northern 2/3 of the state and 2/3 of the population and economy is in the southern 2/3 of the state. And so this system of dams and canals and aqueducts is designed to capture that rain and snow in the north and move it to the south and deliver it 365 days a year, protecting from flooding in the middle, which is an area called the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. And it's kind of the heart of the system. It literally is where we move all the water and then pump it to other places. So it literally is the heart. The second rule of California is 50-40-10. So of that system that captures roughly 15% of all rain and snow, so we actually don't use a lot of what's available to us. We only use about 15%, 15 to 20, depending on the year. The rest goes to nature. Of the 15 to 20% we capture and develop, that's called developed water, 50% of it is designated for environmental protection, 40% of it is for agriculture, and 10% is for municipal and industrial. When the system was originally designed and built, and it kind of finished its last upgrade in the 60s, it was only servicing agriculture and municipal industrial. Since the 1990s and the advent of the Endangered Species Act and various other requirements in the environmental protection sphere, we've added a third water user, which is these government protections, these environmental protections, and we've made it the largest water user on a system that was never designed to do that. Now, we've managed through it, but that has added to this idea of scarcity because the system hasn't been upgraded since the 60s. The population was about half the size it was, and we didn't have the priority set that we have today.
Do you mind explaining that? Because what do you mean?
So the system was originally designed for delivering water to agriculture and to cities, right? Municipal and industrial uses. From about the 1970s, but really the 1990s on, the idea for protecting various species of fish, water quality, predominantly species and water quality, we needed, and temperature control, we needed to dedicate part of the developed water to environmental protection. So moving water during certain times of year to provide necessary flow for migrating salmon, to provide turbid water for delta smelt, to provide, to push salt water out to the ocean and keep it from inundating near the Sacramento area, to hold temperatures in Shasta so that they would be cold enough when we released it for salmon in the winter. These all became requirements on the water supply that were mandated by environmental law. And so what happened was they partitioned out 50% of it for these reasons.
So it was added without adjusting the rest of the equation. But what are your thoughts on it? Should it not have been added? Should it be adjusted overall? Like what would really be the, I mean, you're the water lady. What would be the solution there?
Sure. So it's not, I always tell people it's not right. It's not wrong. It is. What is important is that it works. And that is where you only know that over time. That's why biological opinions, which are the scientific analysis by our fishery agencies, so National Marine Fisheries at the Department of Commerce and the Fish and Wildlife Service at the U.S. Fish and Department of Interior, they do analysis called biological opinions, where they're looking at a species and the effects of an action on the species. Those usually take 10 years to redo because you want to gather enough data to see if the action you're doing has had an effect, right? And what the effect has been. So as we've gone through since the 1990s, this idea of pushing more water for the species, we've been tracking the numbers and the species aren't recovering. And yet our only prescription for this has been we need to dedicate more water to do this. And yet they're not seeing the recovery rate that they would like to see. So that tells me, okay, what we have prescribed isn't the only thing that is causing, that is an effect on the species. What other effects are taking place on the species? The biological opinions for the most contested ones that everybody knows about are the delta smelt. And then we actually had another one that followed right after it for fall run salmon, green sturgeon, and the killer whale. And that was the first time a biological opinion actually bundled species and looked at multiple species under one action. The effect of both of those biological opinions at one time actually limited the ability to move water from north to south to 1 month out of the year at 1/6 capacity. So immediately that was taken to court because it completely hamstrung the absolute hydrovascular system of the state. So it was taken to court and it was found that the biological opinions, they have the authority to do this under the Endangered Species Act, but that they didn't look at all of the factors affecting the species and they didn't look at the human impact of the decision. Interestingly enough, the law didn't require them to look into the human impact of the decision. That's not required under the law. So that's something that was actually addressed in the last few years under the Endangered Species Act, was looking at the economic and human impact of actions that need to be incorporated. This idea of finding balance in how we manage our environment and manage our resources and the effects on our populations. I don't think it's wrong. I think what has me disturbed is obviously shoving that amount of water had a massive effect on the socioeconomic side. Over 1 million acres fallowed or abandoned permanently. At the peak of a drought cycle under those laws, you saw massive unemployment, in some places 40%, because of just every acre of irrigated ag land in California supports 11 jobs. So anytime an acre is taken out of production, just multiply by 11. So when you have 1 million acres abandoned, multiply by 11, that's how many jobs don't exist. You put any more acreage on top of that, at the peak of the 2013-2015 drought cycle, where we still had these environmental laws in place and it was an actual drought, natural drought, you had up almost 2 million acres out of production. So my third rule of California water is this: a drought is caused by nature and God. A water shortage is caused by a management decision. So what has happened is the species have declined, the economy has declined in some places. And so we have a round the circle failure here. So what does it take to re-examine? And if water needs to be dedicated for fish and it's working, no one's going to argue with that. No farmer will argue with that, because we have modernized. We have massively invested in alternative irrigation and become highly efficient with our water. So much so that we are delivering water more direct to root zone, that we are not recharging our groundwater aquifer. Now it's the unintended consequence of good action. And now that has become an increasing demand and pressure on our water supply as our aquifers have become overdrafted. They've become overdrafted because the surface water that was delivered 365 days a year was no longer being used to recharge them. As that began to dwindle off and we went from 100% deliveries to 60% deliveries to 40% deliveries, then the alternative to make up the difference was to start pumping more groundwater without that regular recharge.
Before we move on and go deeper into water management, and yes, to almonds, I wanted to review with you Aubrey's three rules for California water. 1. Most of the water and snow, 2/3 of it, falls in the northern 2/3 of the state and is used in the southern 2/3 of the state, where 2/3 of the population and economy resides, so there's a lot of water moving around. 2. Developed water. About 15% of what falls that is used by us is distributed as follows: 50% to environmental protection, 40% to agriculture, and 10% to municipalities and industrial uses. The system was developed in the 1960s to serve agriculture and municipalities, and the environmental protections were added in the 1990s without an update to the system. The third rule is that drought is caused by nature. A water shortage is caused by human resource management. Each of these rules, as Aubrey described them, are centered on water distribution by nature and by us. And if you're following along with all that she knows and shares so far, you understand that we can manage our water better to address new priorities like environmental protection and historical and future needs like serving the agricultural industry so we can grow enough food and provide water to people where they live and work. I hope that this helps us stay together on all of this insight that Aubrey is sharing with us. Let's keep going.
So just as farmers are becoming more efficient at delivering less water for maximum growth to their crops, there's a problem. There's a domino effect. A ripple effect, if you will, you know, everywhere you go with water decisions.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that the situation we're in is impossible, but it is definitely the impossible part is, one, this idea that when we keep throwing good water and good money and good resources at something that's not working, I want to see species recover. We have seen species recover, interestingly enough, where we invest in habitat, where we invest in mitigation, habitat, and farm raising and releasing. We actually have seen species recover, and we have seen some really great stories. And I've seen that not only in California, but I've seen that across the West, where we actually do know how to manage species very well. So we have to abandon this idea that it's just water that is the solution. It's part of it. You know, alternatively, the unintended consequence that's happened downstream has become a problem as well. And so we are facing a challenge of acknowledging that we need reliable water supply in addition to demand control if we're going to get the aquifer back to parity, which then allows for flexibility of our surface water supplies. We need to get ourselves back to this parity. We've almost sacrificed ourselves on the altar of of progression too fast. And my concern is the regulations pile up too fast and we don't get a chance to catch up. We don't get a chance to look at the data and see what works and what doesn't. And so we just keep throwing more resources at it instead of requiring accountability that we hold ourselves to. You know, in farming, you and I both know, we're not going to throw money and resources at something that keeps failing. We're going to figure out what we have to do differently to be successful. I think we should require the same of our environmental protection. It is absolutely outrageous to me that we have allowed these species to become almost extinct despite all of our efforts. If what we were doing was working, I'd be the first one to say, double the budget and cut the timeline in half. But that's not what's happening. So we should stop what we're doing, hold it accountable, and finance success and re-examine failure.
Is that an unpopular opinion?
I think it depends on who you're talking to. I know I have shocked friends on both sides of the aisle when I've said that. I think the accountability metric makes people nervous because, oh no, it's science and it's earth and we have to give it time. And I'm going, look, we have man-managed our environment up until now. We are dedicating water that a man put behind a dam to protect species by releasing water at specific times. That is not natural. There's nothing natural about that. So why not manage it like we mean it and require success? The same way I would require efficiency and success from anyone I would deliver that water to. I don't want to see a city waste water. I don't want to see a farmer waste water. We should treat it with respect, both the resource and the land and the air and the soil, all of it. Those resources take care of us. I never thought I'd be a sustainability champion, and now I'm passionate about it.
I see that. Let's fast forward for a minute to almonds. So now you are the head of the Almond Alliance, and here are the buzzwords I know about almonds. That one almond takes 1.1 gallons of water.
Sure.
Is it something that you have to fight, like the PR on this? I'm just curious, like, that's a little nut and a lot of water. So is it a lot of water? And obviously you've been hired for your water chops. I just want to understand, what are you in the middle of here?
So, yeah, I know. I keep thinking that it is my destiny to take on challenging projects. So yeah, I hear that, oh wow, almonds use a lot of water. And I remember distinctly telling a waitress in Malibu who served me delicious almond pancakes when she said, oh yeah, almonds use a lot of water. And I think I just put my fork down and I went, you know, if you stop serving the pancakes, I'll stop growing them. There is a supply and demand thing here, you know, and interestingly enough, you know, if you look at focus groups, until you bring up how much water an almond uses, they really don't think about it. The consumer isn't there yet. And here's the other part that I try to tell people. Now that's the snarky, me getting my Spaniard up answer, right? My mother's a Spaniard, so that's just me getting that going on. But the reality of it is this, you can calculate out that it takes 1.1 gallon to grow a nut, sure. That also is a tree that I keep alive 365 days a year. A beautiful orchard that is sequestering carbon, that is providing habitat, that is providing food for bees, native and pollinators, that is aerating soils and part of this ecosystem that we've created. And like all farmers, we don't have a choice of not going to work or not getting to something because something alive is dependent on us. And so I think the part that's short-sighted is, yeah, it takes that much to grow an almond, but you left out the part that this is a tree that's alive 365 days a year that is filling an incredible need in our ecosystem.
Are pollinators pollinating out there and in the land of almonds? Because I know that they're all, the almond trees are acres and acres of almond trees as far as you can see. I bet it smells amazing. But people are shipping bees across the country to pollinate them.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we do have native pollinators. And actually, one thing the Almond Alliance is working on, we worked in the legislature last year to work very closely. Actually, we ended up, the legislature took up the charge and then the governor actually doubled it up in his budget to work with farmers to develop pollinator habitat. So how do we use our existing farming practice of using bees that we truck in, but also how do we use our existing farms to develop habitat and food sources for native pollinators and propagate native pollinators? How do we improve our practices to mitigate loss or effect on native pollinators? So this is something we're actively working in. The Almond Board of California, which is our federal marketing order, they've done a ton of research in this space as well. We work very closely with them on that. And this is something that I'm growing more interested in, and we're actually actively working with some partners who work with developing native seeds. So how do we take a managed environment and more integrate our farming practices into some of the more natural of where we are in order to help propagate more natural environment flora and fauna for critters that we work on independent. We're finding some interesting study with them that actually when we develop hedgerow or we develop some habitat around our operations, we actually kind of prime the pump with the natives and with the imported bees that actually makes them healthier, happier, and more productive when they're out working our fields. So, you know, this is all a part of this more integrated farming practice that I, you know, this more sustainable, integrated, conscious farming practice that, you know, it makes sense dollars and cents wise, and it's good for the environment. So we're achieving an environmental outcome that we are setting for ourselves, and we are providing that economic viability for ourselves in the process.
I interview a lot of farmers, and recently I've been hearing a lot about how farmers take this really holistic view of things, obviously, because they're on land, raising animals, dealing with water, dealing with infrastructure, dealing with politics. Like, there's a lot that a farmer deals with. They're serving as chemists and veterinarians and what have you. It seems like you may have inherited this holistic approach to looking at a lot more than, you know, what's in front of you.
I think we have to. I think it's in our nature, to your point, right? Every farmer has to be the, and anymore, they have to be the accountant, the compliance officer, the HR director, the, you know, one time just back of the envelope with a friend of mine, they have a plant health company and now they're merged with a irrigation company. We sat down and just, how many agencies does a farmer have to be in compliance with average on, you know, in a year, right? And just picked a random town in California, random county in California. And we just kind of went through the list from local to federal. We came up with 86 separate agencies. 86 separate agencies that we are filling out paperwork and likely paying to be in compliance with.
Does this astonish you? Be honest. Did you think about the work that farmers do, getting up with the sun, working the farm, dealing with farm equipment, harvesting, figuring out the market for their goods, whether that's a farmer's market or a processor or a distribution company, all of that, and then on top of it, 86 agencies? Not to mention the bank and the bills. I never would have guessed 86 or even 10, really.
And so it is not uncommon. You hear probably a lot of farmers say it. I do too, that, you know, I'm in more meetings than I am in the farm. And I'm in more offices and I'm doing more time in front of my computer than I am out, you know, working ground.
If you have the opportunity, knowing what you know as a farm diva in California and a real on the ground water expert with a PhD in government acronyms and all of the people behind them and their missions, what's the one thing you'd fix?
I think I would really push for accountability in our environmental programs. I would require them to be successful and to take that more holistic approach. I would couple that with a very transactional approach to things. We really need to eliminate barriers to entry for implementing new practices or quantifying and granting credit where it belongs when we are successful. I think we're in an incredible moment of growth in that sector right now, and we're racing against ourselves. We're getting pressure from our consumer and pressure from our food suppliers, providers. I'm worried policy isn't caught up. I'm worried regulations are going to start taking place and the people writing them are not going to be us, you know, with any knowledge of how, what works and what doesn't. It's going to be pie in the sky stuff. And this could be a total Californian perspective because we deal with this all the time. California, I love us, but we have a tendency to set marks that they're not achievable, and it's honorable, but it, you know, come on, you know, it's just not possible. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be something we aim for. We should bring into balance the idea of finding achievable goals, setting ourselves up to be successful in that. Once you get to that place on that mountain, you can see further and you can set another achievable goal and go get it. I firmly believe that we absolutely have to continue to grow more on less farmland or as much farmland as we have. I don't see us getting any new farmland.
This is an aside, but one worth mentioning to you if you are interested in this issue of farmland. We have a lot of people to feed, right? Bill Gates is actually the largest owner of farmland in America. Did you know that? Check out the interview with White Oak Pastures farmer Will Harris as we discuss this in episode 23 I'll drop a link in the show notes for you.
I think we need to find value with our consumer again. We need to rebuild that relationship again. And we need to, I don't know how to do it. I have ideas of how to do it, but I'm not positive. But I just feel, I have felt very drawn to in the last few years, the idea that we need to reestablish a relationship with our consumer, and that our consumer should find us of value and be an advocate with us as we are an advocate for them.
This is the crux of Talk Farm to Me. What is the point of farming if there's not a consumer on the other end? And what an important role that is. But if you're just eating blind as a consumer, you're only doing a part of your job. To know more, to know farmers, that's the idea.
I mean, how often I find us in the ag sector saying we're trying to look out for our consumer. We're trying to develop the safest, most viable product, affordable product for our consumer. And our consumer doesn't see it that way. Our consumer sometimes doesn't even see us.
I do have a theory, and Talk Farm to Me is working to combat it. Farmers are invisible, and I don't think they should be anymore. When you hear a song on the radio, you see the singer. You know them. When you eat an almond, who do you see?
So if we could reestablish that connection of what the importance of the American farmer is in our society and make that an essential value in how we make decisions, both at the grocery store, but even in politics, I think would do our society well in the long term. In terms of, I think I outlined in terms of what I would change from a water and ag perspective outside of the almond world, that accountability in our environmental programs would affect a lot of things, from water to soil to air. And I think, and also our environment, I think we would actually be successful if we demanded results from ourselves on a timeline and said, you have to perform. And if you don't, we got to stop what we're doing and find something else that works. Either we have to readjust what the goal is, or we have to readjust what the prescription for solution is.
I'm going to paraphrase here for a second. I filled Aubrey in on the Four Farmers community and movement that I and a group of founders, including farmers and non-farmers from across the country, are spearheading. And I wanted to share her perspective on farmers' roles in the opportunity to be for farmers. She shares some pretty direct advice for farmers themselves and for all of us to bridge the divide between farmers and non-farmers. Listen closely.
I even find myself like in this total dichotomy, right? One is, I'm just so over the victim mentality in farming. I think we need to just stand on our two feet and be proud and command respect for who we are and the amazing things that we do. But I am just over the, we cannot keep walking into rooms being like, you're just hurting us. Yeah, they are. Have you offered them a solution? Have you told them like, hey, this isn't feasible and here's why, but here's what I can do? I've gotten extremely transactional. Like I said, I'm just kind of like, all right, if you want to achieve these goals, you're going to need open land. And the only people who know how to do that are farmers. So you actually need us if you want to hit your carbon sequestration goal. If you want to hit your water conservation goals, you actually need us if you want to achieve whatever sustainable metric you're trying to achieve. You need us.
Right.
And in that middle section, the business side, the supply chain, the vertically integrated, whether I'm talking to water districts or I'm talking to food companies, they're figuring it out. But now I need them to leverage that on the policy, right? And be like, hey, so that means you need to weigh in here when we're getting restricted on the necessary inputs we need to do what we're doing. But the flip side of that too is, you know, it's always finding out what motivates somebody else and can you align that with what you're trying to get? And that's a large part of it. So I'm kind of over the victim thing. At the same time, you know, it is the idea of commanding respect. It is and I think what you're doing is beautiful. We're caught in this weird world where, yeah, we want more people to be for farmers. And yet there's this, you know, how much do we hear about transparency and people, you know, you go to a restaurant and it says beef from blah, blah, blah farm. Well, people want that. They want the transparency. They want the story. They want the romance. I think we should harness it, right? And wherever we can. I used to tell people if you wanted to survive farming anymore, in California at least, you needed to sell out. So, you know, sell probably part of your property, part of your operation. You were going to have to consolidate. You needed to sell in, so you would have cover if you were farming for a larger entity, like my family does. We farm on contract for Mariani Nut, it's a company that we work with, or someone else. And you need to hipster up a little bit. You need to do a little niche marketing. You need to do a little direct to consumer. You need to do just a little something, something on the side. One, I think it's good for you. It makes you feel good. It's catharsis. Two, it really, you know, this is what our consumers want. And I think our bigger companies, they want to have the story to incorporate, and it gives you cover. It lets us put a face to who and what we are and what we're doing so that we can keep doing it, because it's really hard to say no to someone you know. And I learned that in government, actually. I did my career backwards. I'm not a government creature by any means. The joke was I was in the world, not of the world, and I couldn't wait to get out. And I didn't work on the Hill. I wasn't a typical, you know, kind of path to that place. But I remember sitting in meetings, and even with my own colleagues who we were on the same team, we would good fight with each other. When we fight, it's not a bad thing. Fighting is a form of communication, and it should make for better policy, right? I'm a firm believer into making a more perfect solution, not the perfect solution, a more perfect solution. And I remember sitting in meetings going, okay, look, I get what you're saying. And the policy you just put forth works really well on paper. But I'm telling you right now, I'm going to push back on you. And I'm going to push back on you because I know the name of the daughter of the person that this is going to affect. I know the face of the man and woman in that place. I know what kind of truck they drive. I know their dog's name. I know who they are. And it's my job to be in this chair, think of that face and that name, and say, what's going to work for them? I now know the same the other way around too. I now can sit out here in the other world and say, yeah, you know, hate government and go after them. And I go, actually, I do know who works on that desk. And that's not who they are. There's another way to do this. So there is something to the personal part of this that it makes it really hard to hate somebody if you know them personally. It makes it really hard to pass blanket judgment if you know a face or a name. And if there's anything I want for the world, getting a little soulful, if there's anything I want for the world, it's for us to have the courage to know ourselves as individuals and to have the courage to know others as individuals.
Did you have any idea that endangered species, water management, farmer pride and self-respect, and 3.2 billion pounds of almonds that come from one state could actually be part of the same conversation? Aubrey Betancourt, public servant, farmer, diplomat, and agitator, has so much to share. As a matter of fact, I couldn't fit all of what I wanted to talk to her about in one interview, nor could I fit all that she had to say into this one episode. If you want to hear more, go to talkfarmtome.com and sign up for my email list, and I will send it to you straight away. I'm going to put the link in the show notes. The bonus material is just 10 more minutes, but we talk about shipping, as in almonds stuck in ports, and about the farm bill. I hope to talk about this more soon, too. In true Aubrey fashion, as our magical unicorn, she weaves in so much in a short amount of time. As always, thanks for being here for Talk Farm to Me. Remember, it's your job to share this episode. I can't think of anyone I know who wouldn't be impressed with the interesting perspectives that Aubrey serves up here. And, yes, we all need to be closer to farmers, to see them, to visualize what they do when we're eating our almonds and our carrots and our burgers. If you are feeling like you are for farmers, I invite you to join the community and the movement to support and see them. Yes, I will provide a link in the show notes so you can find out more. And stay tuned next week when we get sticky with syrup from the sugar bush and a maple farm from Vermont that makes New York City's Union Square Market its home. I'm your host, Farm Girl, and this is Talk Farm to Me.